You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It is Sunday morning, and we are at Kenneth Hahn State Park in South LA.
Hey, how are you?
I love this fit.
And it's crowded.
It's just a sea of beautiful black and brown people.
Marley Ralph helps organize a free yoga class on a grassy meadow at the park. And every week, hundreds of people show up.
It's just people who are old, who are young, people who are new to yoga, who have been doing yoga for years. It's just a sea of diverse individuals who are all here to heal and to enjoy themselves. And it's a very beautiful thing to see.
Now, this isn't just a class for fitness. Marley and her cousin started it 2 years ago as a protest against black lives that were lost to violence. And now, when so many groups that formed after the death of George Floyd are no longer around, this local community movement is still going strong. KCRW's Megan Jamerson picks it up from here.
It all started in Mid-City at L.A. High Memorial Park. It was June 2020, and Marley Ralph's cousin, Etienne Maurice, organized a protest run in memory of Ahmaud Arbery. Marley was helping out. Over 400 people showed up.
And then it was right before we were about to start the run, and Etienne was like, should we do some stretches? You should lead us through some stretches. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'm going to lead us through some stretches. I was a little nervous at first. But then I did it, and it was just an amazing thing. It felt like chaos in that month. Like, it felt like just things were popping off every single day, and you just didn't have any kind of moment to, like, take a pause. But within that moment, I looked around, and people were silent. I had a moment of just silence, of just breathing, of just existing. And I think that we all felt what that felt like, of having a pause amongst all of this chaos. And then it really moved both of us. And Etienne was like, yo, we should probably come back tomorrow and do this again.
Come back next weekend.
We should probably do this again. And so we did. And then we did 10 weeks of protesting on Saturdays and yoga on Sundays. And then yoga was the one that kept going, was our form of protest. And now here we are 2 years later.
The cousins decided to call their wellness movement Walk Good LA. Marley is a yoga instructor. Etienne Maurice is a film producer. And his sister, Ivy Coco Maurice, who is a content creator and entrepreneur, is the third founding member of the group. She says all the free activities they host now, including yoga, runs, and hikes, are rooted in lessons they learned from their grandmother. Even the name Walk Good LA comes from the Jamaican euphemism she raised them on.
Walk good means to go about your day in good stride, to take care, to make sure you look both ways when crossing the street. Whatever that means, to go about your day in a healthy and safe way, that's what walk good means. Know that you have the potential to be a better version of yourself when you leave this space.
The trio are tight-knit with a contagious amount of love for each other.
Brother, sister, cousin, besties.
That's part of what kept them going, says Etienne.
Walk Good LA would not be successful if we weren't out here every Sunday, you know.
Committed.
And there are a lot of other organizations that started back in 2020 that are no longer here, and we haven't stopped.
Maybe you stay right where you are. Or maybe you bring your left hand to your heart and your right hand to your lower belly.
Right now, at this space at Kenneth Hahn Park, the hour-long yoga class is underway.
Allowing your inhales and your exhales to fill.
Lenny Gator has been coming to these free classes since they started 2 years ago, when he learned that they were a response to violence against Black lives.
It's just a different way to respond, you know what I mean? And a way that uplifts us, builds community, makes us stronger, you know, makes us feel better.
He's very into the health benefits from doing this yoga class.
You know, no, it helps with flexibility, and it helps with balance, core strength, and, like, you know, just overall my chakras are aligned and all that, you know, so it's good.
Hold up. That sounds like sarcasm.
I mean, I was kind of joking with the chakras aligned thing, but I actually do think that my chakras are aligned. And the community, you know, just connecting with the community. Like, I'll almost always know someone when I go somewhere. Oh, I know you from Walkgood.
Nearby, Christine Gomez brought her husband with her to introduce him to the practice of yoga.
I was like, come do yoga with black people. Like, it's all people of color, and it's a really cool vibe.
Her husband, Joe, likes the idea of making this a weekly couples outing after noticing how the class made him feel.
I feel like it's more open. You know, I was a little hesitant at first, but then now we're doing yoga, like, I want to say for the first time, felt really good.
And that's the simple feeling of relaxation that Etienne hopes participants leave with and are able to carry with them throughout the week.
I want people to remember to just breathe and that focus on what is in your control. If you have no control over it, it probably doesn't serve you. And I think it's just so easy to forget to breathe. I think yoga is like how I look at life, you know. You're put in these really awkward, difficult positions. But the only thing you could really rely on is your breath and the willingness to do the next pose, to do the next thing, whatever that thing might be. One thing we always just say when we were protesting, we'd say, this is a movement, not a moment. And we've legit created a movement out of healing and community.
As the class nears the end, everyone lays down on their backs for the last resting pose called Shavasana. The instructor, Mel Douglas, leads the group through a meditation.
I leave you with this. I am filled with quiet joy for no reason save the fact that I am alive. The message I receive is clear. There's no time to lose from loving, no place but here to offer kindness, no day but this to be my true, unfettered self and pass the flame from heart to heart. This is the only moment that exists, so simple, so exquisite, and so very real. I'm filled with quiet joy for no reason save the fact that I am alive.
For KCRW, I'm Megan Jamerson.
Coming up, Juneteenth celebrates communication of the emancipation, but word didn't spread very fast about the freeing of enslaved people. And California wasn't as free as it was billed at the beginning. Plus, where to celebrate Juneteenth this weekend. All yours on the other side of this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's KCRW's Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. After the Mexican-American War, California entered the Union in 1850 as a so-called free state. Its constitution said, quote, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude unless for the punishment of crimes shall ever be tolerated in this state, end quote. So, Juneteenth, the upcoming celebration of the end of slavery in the United States, wouldn't seem to have much of a direct connection to local history. Unfortunately, though, the reality of that time in California and Los Angeles wasn't quite so clear-cut. Historian Susan Anderson has studied L.A. history and its connection to slavery and the eventual celebration of Juneteenth. She's the history curator over at the California African American Museum, CAM, as we know it, and she's here with us right now. Hi, Susan.
Hi there.
Thank you for coming on and talking to us. First of all, tell us a little bit about what it meant for California to enter the Union as a so-called free state. I mean, there was a compromise that was involved in all of that, right?
Yeah, that's right. And actually, California was coming into the United States as one of the states was a pivotal, dramatic event. Congress at that time was involved in what was a doomed effort to try to balance the number of states between states that were slave states and states that were so-called free states. And California came in as part of, as you mentioned, the Compromise of 1850. During that decision by Congress, the anti-slavery people got to have the state of California come in as a free state. But on the other side, one of the most drastic aspects of the compromise that brought California into the Union was the new Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, which turned many of the African American population into refugees in their own country, and also put pressure on white people to become vigilantes and help report on people who were escaping slavery. So it was a huge event. And among people who opposed slavery when California adopted its constitution and then came into the Union, there was a lot of rejoicing because it was a state that had a constitution that didn't tolerate slavery in the words of the that clause.
You mentioned, Susan, the Fugitive Slave Act that was part of the compromise in 1850, but just a couple of years later, the California legislature passed its own Fugitive Slave Law, right?
Yes, and if there's any doubt that slavery was practiced in the state of California, knowing that the California legislature passed a fugitive slave law in 1852 ought to put that doubt to rest. There had been a kind of wave of court decisions that favored the constitution of the state and went against people who claimed to own slaves in the courts. Many enslaved people came into the state and found ways to leave the people who claimed to own them. There was a very activist African-American population that assisted in those efforts. And the pro-slavery legislature reacted with California's own fugitive slave law, which was in some ways more restrictive than the federal law.
So talk a little bit about, Susan, you know, if California comes into the Union as a quote-unquote free state, but then a couple of years later, there's this Fugitive Slave Act that's passed by the California legislature. I mean, what does that mean as far as what it looks like on the ground in California as a quote unquote free state? Not so free, right?
Right. But that was true throughout the United States. There was not a state in the United States where slavery wasn't practiced. And California was what historian Ira Berlin would call a society with slaves. So the main system wasn't a plantation system. The main economy didn't rely totally on enslaved labor. But there were a lot of different kinds of labor that you could call unfree in California. And from the period when California came into the United States through the end of the Civil War, there are newspaper reports that have eyewitness testimonies about Southerners who would bring in numbers and numbers of enslaved people with them, whether in the beginning to work in mines or to be their servants or to work on farms or to hire out. So California, like most states that called themselves free states, did tolerate in its courts, in its government, in its official capacity, the practice of slavery.
How did slavery then really end in LA and California?
It really ended because of the activism of Black people. They were the, just like throughout the rest of the country, you know, we have this sort of false picture that when we hear the word abolitionist, we think of white people, we think of kindly Quakers. And just like the civil rights movement was a Black-led movement, the anti-slavery movement in the 19th century was as well. And there's all kinds of documented testimony by everybody from Garrison to Horace Tappan and other white leaders in the abolitionist movement who talk about the primacy of Black leadership. The Black community in 19th century California, through its newspapers, through its institutions, and through its communities, was very active against slavery as part of their overall search for equal rights in California. And their efforts are what was behind the many of the changes that we were able to see. But then, of course, it was the Civil War itself that led to the end of slavery in the United States.
Is that history taught, Susan, in textbooks today?
Not really that I'm aware of. There's some great scholarship that's available, but we're still, you know, in this position where a lot of things that get produced in the academy or produced by academics, it doesn't always filter down to school textbooks or public parks or, you know, a much or more mainstream audience. So we're dealing, when it comes to things like Juneteenth, even the story that's told about Juneteenth isn't even really accurate. But when it comes to knowing, you know, these stories about who the anti-slavery leaders were and how the end of slavery came, we have a long way to go as far as getting those stories out to a more general public.
Susan, you said that even the story of Juneteenth isn't accurate. What does that mean?
What I mean is that almost everything you read says that, you know, the Union Army General Granger, he was appointed the commander of the Texas District after the Civil War. And actually, you know, what people don't realize is that at the end of the war, there was a lot of rebelliousness among the former Confederacy.
Right.
And the army, the United States Army, was sent to the former Confederate states to continue putting down the rebellion and taking over the land and consolidating the victory of the Union. And so Texas was one of those places, one of the most resistant places, where especially the cotton planters, they continued to coerce and use forced black labor. They were going to the courts to try to overturn the Emancipation Proclamation after the Civil War. And it was a very violent place. They were murdering and lynching Black people in hundreds, all in this process at the end of the war. So General Granger was sent, like other commanders, to other southern states. He was sent to Texas. And, you know, the story that we hear is that Black people heard that they were free on Juneteenth. Well, the actual fact is that the U.S. Army was sent to tell the white people in Texas that emancipation was the law and to enforce emancipation on behalf of the victorious Union Army. 50,000 U.S. troops were stationed in Texas to make sure that the law was kept. And actually, African Americans knew what was going on. They knew what had happened with the Civil War. They knew about emancipation. It was the cotton planters and their supporters that refused to go along with it. And that's why the army was in Texas. The army didn't come to Texas to talk to the porters working in the hotels in Galveston and the black stevedores and the maids. They came to talk to the Confederate rebels and show them who was in charge. And in Texas, I mean, part of the meaning of Juneteenth is this, you know, this period when the slave system, the slaveocracy in Texas was involved in a backlash, and they were burning Black people out of their businesses, burning them out of their homes, you know, all kinds of violence, and glorifying the Confederacy and still fighting the Union after the Civil War. African Americans in Texas decided, even in the face of all this, to celebrate emancipation. And they turned that the whole story from one that was glorifying the Confederacy into one that was celebrating emancipation. That's why Juneteenth is important. I think that there's just kind of a lot of incoherence about, you know, why are we celebrating this? And it's, the story is very profound. But there's still a reluctance in the U.S. to tell the truth about what a lot of white people did in history. Nobody wants to talk about that part.
Well, that's where you get the pushback today about critical race theory and all that stuff. And
exactly. People don't want to talk about what actually happened. So. Right.
Susan Anderson, history curator over at the California African American Museum. Susan, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Happy Juneteenth to you.
Yeah, same to you.
Well, there will be Juneteenth celebrations all across Southern California. If you're not sure which ones to check out, Danielle Dorsey is West Coast editor at Thrillist and has some ideas for you. Hey, Danielle.
Hi, Steve.
You just heard from Susan Anderson over at CAM, the California African American Museum, over at Exposition Park. Tell us a little bit more about the pop-up that they're hosting over there.
Yeah, absolutely. So Prosperity Market is going to be hosting a pop-up where you can purchase produce directly from Black farmers, as well as other handmade items from other Black vendors. The virtual farmers market is spearheaded by two young Black women who are working to provide fresh produce to food deserts and support Black farmers and agriculturists. So it's a really great mission to contribute to.
The biggest celebration in LA, I believe, is the one going on in Leimert Park, right?
Oh, absolutely. So if you're in South LA, or even if you're not, Leimert Park's annual celebration is probably going to be one of the most well-attended in the city. There's going to be an African marketplace, plenty of Pan-African food and drink, live music, dance performances, art, anything you can think of. And it's happening all day and it's free to attend.
It's free to attend. Of course, Leimert Park is south of the 10 freeway in South LA. Well attended means there's going to be like thousands of people there.
Yeah, there will definitely, there definitely are going to be a lot of people. It is going to be outdoors, but you can expect crowds, definitely.
Expect crowds and all of that going on there. There's going to be an event, I know, this weekend in Santa Monica on Saturday. And actually, this event was started 30 years ago by a local in Santa Monica. What's going on there?
Yeah, so Santa Monica is going to be hosting their 30th annual celebration, which is going to include recitations of original Juneteenth texts. It's going to include food, other vendors, live music. And then there will be closing remarks from Miss Laverne Ross, who is the local who actually brought the idea to the city of Santa Monica 30 years ago, saying, you know, this is a holiday that I celebrated in Texas, and we should be celebrating it here, too. So don't want to miss that.
We got the history lesson, right, about how Juneteenth was a Texas thing, but it was all over, right, in places where there were enslaved people who had been emancipated. And I know, you know, even here in California, it was slow to make its way, you know, as a celebration. Have you seen just in recent years more people celebrating this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we are seeing two things. One is that celebrations like the one in Santa Monica are becoming more well known. But then you also have all of these people who are learning about the holiday and really wanting to be involved, who are also, you know, doing different events and celebrating in all sorts of ways.
And it's about history as well, understanding the history of what this really means. And I think that's an important thing to remember. I know there's another celebration going on in downtown L.A., right, at L.A. Live?
Yes. So Fixin's Soul Kitchen, a soul food restaurant right down in the middle of L.A. Live, is going to be hosting a celebration all day. And so if you are craving some Southern staples like shrimp and grits or fried chicken, yeah, that is the place to go. They're going to have lawn games, a beer garden, and tickets are just $16.95. So it's definitely a great deal.
Oh, that makes me so hungry. So the actual holiday is on Sunday, but these celebrations are pretty much all weekend, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You will find celebrations on Saturday and Sunday, with a lot of organizations giving their employees the day off on Sunday to be able to observe the holiday.
Right, and some on Monday as well. What about some other ways to celebrate if maybe you didn't want to go to one of these crowded places?
Yeah, so if you want to contribute to a good cause, but maybe you don't want to mix and mingle, Gather for Good is a nonprofit, and they are hosting their annual Pies for Justice Juneteenth bake sale. And so countless LA restaurants and chefs are contributing one-of-a-kind creations, and all of the proceeds are going to be split between Kindred Space LA, which is a Black-owned birthing center in South LA, and it will also be split between Everytown, which is an organization fighting to end gun violence. And so you can visit the website andgatherforgood.com to buy a pie and get involved.
Right on. All right. Well, so this weekend, a lot of celebrations happening all around Greater LA. Danielle Dorsey, we're going to have a link, by the way, at our website to your list. Danielle Dorsey, West Coast editor over at Thrillist. Danielle, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
And by the way, if that weren't enough, there's a big show at the Hollywood Bowl on Sunday. Earth, Wind & Fire, Chaka Khan, Billy Porter, the list goes on and on. If you can join a lot of folks there at the Hollywood Bowl on Sunday. If you can't make it, it's being carried live on CNN, starting at 7 Eastern, 4 Pacific, on Sunday afternoon. That's it for us today. Next week, drought is making for brown lawns and water restrictions. What are cemeteries? Cemeteries, you know, with all that grass, what are they doing? And come along as we chronicle a night with the Pride Poets Hotline. That's next week on GLA. Check us out anytime at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Share your thoughts. Subscribe to the podcast. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Robin Estrin, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, PJ Shahamet, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for the ear. Have a great night.